Oh, yeah, we've got Bucks and Brewers fever, and it is high time to talk about this incredible moment in Milwaukee pro sports. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we are at the onset of the NBA playoffs, and we have this rising superstar in Giannis Antetokounmpo. The New York Times calls him the face and chief culture setter in the Bucks transformation. He's a front runner this year for league MVP. Meanwhile, recall the Brewers are fresh off their first division title since 2011. They were just that one heartbreaking loss shy of the World Series last year. And there's this outfielder, Christian Yelich, who's providing just as he did in 2018, just more good stuff. Are you watching this moment? What is your level of excitement? Are you a diehard fan or just hopping on the bandwagon? We're at 800-642-1234. ESPN writer Bradford Doolittle covers baseball. He recently wrote about Milwaukee's superstars in baseball and basketball. Bradford, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. How are you?
I'm well. So is it rare for a smaller franchise market like Milwaukee to have superstars in baseball and basketball at the same time?
Well, it is fairly rare, especially the baseball side of it, because the economics of the sport tend to be tilted towards the bigger markets, and that usually manifests in the superstars in the league going to New York and Los Angeles and Chicago. And the fact that Milwaukee has two players at the pinnacle of their sport at the same time is rare for a small market, and it's rare for Milwaukee.
So you wrote about visiting Milwaukee recently. What was your sense of how fans are responding?
Well, there's a lot of enthusiasm. It wasn't an average random day that I was there. It was the Brewers' opening day at Miller Park, and it was also that night the Bucks had a game against the Los Angeles Clippers. So there was a lot of activity around downtown, and I'm based in Chicago. I've been going to Milwaukee for work for a number of years, back when I used to cover the NBA primarily, and now it's baseball. And I always noticed that when you would see sports fans out and about, and Wisconsin is a huge sports state, Milwaukee a very big sports town, but the Green Bay Packers tended to dominate what you would see people representing as far as merchandise and attire and jackets and stocking caps. And in this particular trip, I barely saw any evidence of the Green Bay Packers, but I saw Brewers and Bucks merchandise everywhere. And Miller Park was a beehive of activity when I was there during the day. And then I got downtown, and it was just as active down around the new arena that the Bucks are playing in and all around downtown. So it was really a scene that's much different than I've witnessed in the years that I've been going up there.
Some curious thing you wrote about, a person wearing a Packers jersey with the number 34 on it. What struck you there?
Well, as I said, I couldn't help but notice just how many people were walking around in Brewers and Bucks merchandise. And it's especially stark when it comes to the Bucks, because I remember going up there just on an average January weekend once a few years ago and checking into my hotel downtown. And I was in town to work on a story about what, I can't recall which team it was, but it was the team that the Bucks were playing, not on the Bucks. But the young woman at the desk asked me what I was in town for. And I said, well, I'm here for the Bucks game. And she looked at me as if I, had a second head, she didn't quite understand what I was talking about. And she said, oh yes, the basketball team, but it didn't really clarify it. So, and I remember then that was, the Packers may have still been playing in the playoffs at the time, but there was a lot of Packers fans around downtown. And on this, I'm looking around purposely keeping my eyes out, just seeing people who are taking advantage of just the general sports enthusiasm to wear their Packers gear, and I didn't see any. Well, and then over near that Wisconsin Hall of Fame that they have along the street with the plaques outdoors, I saw one guy wearing a Packers jersey, and I thought, well, there's a Packers fan. And it was number 34, and I don't know who wears that number on the Packers. And he turned around, and it was a Greek Freak on the back. It was a jersey that he adapted to Giannis that just happened to be the Packers colors.
Well, riddle me this, because the Packers, they haven't reached the playoffs for a few years. And has the Packs, let's just call it descent, slight descent, factored into the rise of the Brewers and the Bucks in any way in terms of popularity?
I would say it's just a happy coincidence. I think there's plenty of room on the sports scene for everybody. You know, the Packers are one of the traditionally one of the most well-run franchises in their sport. And, you know, everything is cyclical and they haven't had the best couple of years, but they still have one of the premier players in sports and most recognizable faces in Aaron Rodgers, who, by the way, was at the Bucks game last night. You know, it's not that they've pushed the Bucks and Brewers have pushed the Packers out of the limelight. It's just for the time being, the Packers have kind of retreated to the side. You know, if the Packers have a bounce back season and make a run at a Super Bowl, I'm sure the fever pitch for them will grow just as loud as it ever has.
Talking with Bradford Doolittle, he's an ESPN writer covering baseball, recently wrote about Milwaukee's dual success in baseball and basketball. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow the Bucks, the Brewers, both? Do you feel this fever pitch moment in Milwaukee? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Mary now joining us from Viola. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I love the Brewers, and I've always loved baseball. I loved the Braves when I was a kid growing up in Milwaukee. Sister Damien used to load us up from St. Mary's grade school, and we had three school buses, and we went to the opener game. And we sat in the bleachers. It was a day off from school. But I love Orlando Arcia and Christian Yelich and Travis Shaw and the closer pitcher, I can't think of his name, Ryan Braun, Bob Uecker and Jeff Levering. All those guys are just awesome. Craig Counsell, I love listening to Craig, whether they've won or lost a game. You know, he's so calm and...
Well, it sounds like, Mary, you love the whole experience. You're embracing
it. I do. One of my sons has played baseball through high school, and he's a farmer now. Like, I was a farmer out here for, almost all my adult life. So I haven't ever watched. I've watched the Brewers a little bit on TV, but I don't have pay TV out here, so... It's my little plug-in radio, and I can listen and keep doing what I'm doing. So,
well, Mary, thank you for calling in. Brad, look at that love.
Yeah, and I can personally identify with Mary's story. I grew up on a farm in Iowa, and we did not have access to cable television when I was younger. We eventually got one of those UFO-sized satellite dishes when I was a teenager, but I fell in love with baseball by listening on AM radio, the Kansas City Royals. And I also fell in love with the NBA, having to pick up signals from these faraway cities on my AM radio and go to different parts of the house to pick it up. So, you know, it's a very similar thing in Wisconsin. And it's great to hear that the game means that much to her.
We're talking about the Bucks and Brewers, good at the same time, and what to make of this moment. Brad Doolittle is an ESPN writer covering baseball. He recently wrote about Milwaukee's dual success in baseball and basketball. You can join in 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Giannis Antetokounmpo? What do you want to know about Christian Yelich? Are we witnessing a new era in Wisconsin pro sports? And if you're a longtime fan of one of these franchises, what's changed for you? Are these rising stars the stuff of greatness, legends in the making? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick this up in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about this remarkable moment in pro sports, sizing up the potential of the Bucks and Brewers here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. ESPN's Bradford Doolittle is tallying up some comparisons, and he points out that rarely have the Brewers and Bucks been in lockstep, that is, good at the same time, Last year was the first calendar year in which both teams made the playoffs since it happened in back-to-back seasons in 81-82. Were you a fan of the Bucks or Brewers way back when? How sweet is this moment now? What would a championship season mean for you, to fellow fans, to Milwaukee and Wisconsin? The sports world at large. Join in 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. ESPN writer Brad Doolittle stays with us. Brad, we haven't given too much love here to Giannis. What should we know about him? What makes him a difficult opponent for other teams?
Well, he is nearly 7 foot tall, so that is one problem. Of course, there are a lot of players who are that tall in the NBA, but they tend to be of a couple of different types. Either they will play, primarily defense for a team, and then on the other end they'll roll to the basket after pick and roll plays and rebound, or maybe like the Bucks center Brook Lopez does, they may spot up around the 3-point line and take set jump shots. Giannis is a 7-footer in body, but he is a point guard in mind, meaning that he handles the ball, he creates plays for his teammates, and he does that not just in a way that's unusual for a 7-footer. It would be unusual if he was 6'3", if he had the prototypical point guard's body. He's just that fluid in the way that he moves and the way that he attacks the game. But at the same time, on the defensive end, because of his size and his athleticism and quickness in moving side to side, he is one of the few, if not the only, player who can legitimately guard probably every other player in the league. And it's the combination of all of those skills on both ends of the court that truly makes him possibly the best all-around player in the NBA right now, and certainly one of the most gifted and as the front runner for this year's MVP award.
You covered the NBA during his early seasons. What was he like back then? You actually captured him saying he wanted to become more like Kobe Bryant. Is he there yet? Kobe won 5 championships.
Well, he's not there in terms of team success, but obviously he's on the right track with the Bucks finishing this regular season with the best record in the NBA, currently leading their first-round series against the Detroit Pistons 2-0, and they won both of those games in dominating fashion. You know, winning a championship in the NBA is always difficult, and it's going to be a long road for them. But if the Bucks won this year's title, it would certainly be no surprise. So he would have one under his belt. He's a different kind of player than Kobe. Kobe was a guy who did play both ends of the floor, but he didn't have the versatility to guard the array of opponents that Giannis can. But on offense, Kobe was one of the great shot makers of all time, and Giannis doesn't quite have that shot-making ability in his game yet. But, if you're going to set your sights on becoming a certain kind of player, Kobe Bryant is definitely the kind of guy that you like to target.
Let's go back to the phones now with Simon in Sauk with some thoughts. Hi, Simon.
Hi there. Brad, I'd just like to kind of get your take on, have you ever seen two sports that are in the same city where we've had elder statesmen kind of running the show with Doug Melvin and John Hammond kind of transition to young, new leadership and the transformation be so immediate? I'll take your comments off the air.
Well, there's a couple of things there. First of all, the transition to the younger, more analytically minded executive, that's a trend that's going on across all sports, including football, including hockey. And it's been going on for a few years. And the ownership groups in Milwaukee were definitely part of that wave in selecting the people to run their teams that they have. Now, the Bucks transition began with the drafting of Giannis, and Giannis was not a top 10 pick. I think he went at number 13 the year that the Bucks drafted him. And the general manager at the time was John Hammond, and he's more of an old school, traditional scouting type of an executive, a wonderful man, and did a great job during his time running the Bucks. before he gave way to the group that they have now. And then David Stearns, who runs the front office of the Brewers, he's kind of a maverick in that the model for remaking a baseball franchise at the moment is if you kind of have to go down to go back up. In other words, you want to strip down payroll. You want to acquire as many young players and prospects as you can, and you're going to lose a lot of games for a few years while you go through that process. Well, he didn't quite strip down to nothing. The Brewers had a couple of off years, but that was it. He managed to remake the organization from top to bottom while remaining competitive at the same time, and he's proven that you can do that without limiting the ceiling of your program. So the Brewers came up one game from the World Series last year. They're a team that looks capable of getting back to that stage or even further this year. And they've done it without really putting their fans through the really arduous wait to, you know, watch 100 losses a year for 4 or 5 years.
So, meanwhile, these franchises are getting a whole lot more profitable, more lucrative.
Well, certainly. I mean, the Bucks, one thing to remember about them is at the time that they drafted Giannis a few years ago, there was a lot of talk that the Bucks were going to leave. I think everybody sort of assumed that they would be the next professional basketball team in Seattle, Washington. And since they were acquired by the ownership group led by Mark Lazary and Wes Edens, they have invested in the organization. They've got the new arena built. They've got the economic development that's going on around the new arena. And they've really cemented the future of the Bucks as a franchise. It's going to be in Milwaukee for a long time. And like I said, a few years ago, I went up there. There were a lot of empty seats, and there was just a lack of awareness that the Bucks were even there. And now it's very much sort of reclaimed its place in the Milwaukee sports culture.
Well, let's shift our attention here to the Brewers and look at Christian Yelich for a moment, voted the National League's MVP last year. What's in Yelich, and what is he likely to do for us this year?
Well, he's shown every sign of being even better than he was last year. He's off to a tremendous start. He's got 9 home runs and 24 RBIs, and it's a start that the Bucks or the Brewers have needed because they have a lot of injuries with their pitching staff, and they've kind of struggled in that area. One thing that's common between Yelich and Giannis is that they are both guys who you can kind of count on reaching whatever the maximum production they're going to get from their potential because they have tremendous work ethic. They have a lot of awareness about their own strengths and weaknesses and are very methodical about going about improving the areas where they're not as good. And so even though Yelich, he's 27 years old, that tends to be kind of the peak age for an offensive player in baseball. But he just has shown a propensity to keep getting better and better. So I would say that as long as he's with the Brewers, you can sort of count on this kind of a player.
How long can we expect to see him in a Brewers uniform? When does his contract expire?
Well, he's got a very friendly contract from a team standpoint. The last year on it is a team option for the 2022 season. So it's 3 more years after this one. At any point within that window, the Brewers can approach him about signing an extension to that. When this contract is up, Yelich will be 30 years old, and the trend of baseball right now is to not give massive long-term contracts to players once they get to the age of 30 and beyond. I can kind of see Yelich being considered a special case, both because of how good he is and because he's just become so embedded in Milwaukee and you know, he's a winning player. The fans embrace him. His teammates embrace him. And he really seems to love playing in a city that is so gaga over a sports team.
So,
that bodes well.
So do Antetokounmpo and Yelich know each other?
They do not. I spoke to them both, and they both talked admiringly about each other. And they both were aware that they've been in the same venue at the same time. Yelich attended a Bucks game during spring training when the Bucks were playing in Phoenix, and Giannis saw him up on the scoreboard and thought, well, who's that guy? that they're making such a big deal about, and then found out it was the MVP. And then it clicked in his mind. He's like, oh, yeah, I've been seeing his picture on billboards all over town. And so he kind of read up on him about him a little bit. And for his part, Yelich said he had planned after that game to go back and introduce himself and say hello, but the Bucks lost the game. And he knows that after you lose, you might not necessarily be in the mood to meet anybody. And so he didn't go back there. So after I talked to Giannis, I went back to Yelich again the next day and I said, hey, we got to get you two together. This is crazy. You know, it's Milwaukee and, you know, you guys could be the MVPs at the same time. And there's a lot of opportunities there. And he says, yeah, we'll get together at some point, I'm sure. So
it would make a photo op for sure. Brad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bradford Doolittle is an ESPN writer. Up next, it's news. Then we'll speak with Governor Tony Evers' cabinet pick to oversee Wisconsin state prisons. Also, join us this morning at 8:30 for NPR News special coverage on details of the Mueller report. Attorney General William Barr will be holding a news conference. We're taking it live at 8:30 right here on the Ideas Network. It's a conversation with the Corrections Secretary here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A federal investigation into alleged civil rights violations at Lincoln Hills Youth Prison ended without charges last week. But now a new report this week from a court-ordered monitor indicates that inmates at the state's youth prison are still being strip-searched, still being pepper-sprayed by guards, despite a federal court order to limit these practices. What questions do you have for the leader of the Department of Corrections? Do you support Governor Evers' proposal regarding criminal justice, like raising pay for correctional officers? Join in at 800-642-1234. Kevin Carr is Secretary Designee for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Secretary Carr, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, Kate, and good morning to your listeners. I'm happy to be with you today.
We're going to get to Lincoln Hills in just a moment, but some background on you first. Before this nomination, you were a U.S. Marshal, and then prior to that, you spent 30 years in the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department. How does that experience inform the decisions you're making as the head of DOC?
Well, my law enforcement experience gives me a perspective on really the front end of the system, and now I'm responsible for what some might call the back end of the system, where we have to care for those in our custody and hopefully change their lives in a positive way. So my 39 years of law enforcement experience, and many of those years were spent working for the Milwaukee Sheriff's Office, where at one time we ran both the House of Correction and the county jail in Milwaukee, provides me with a point of view that I think brings a fresh set of eyes to the department.
Well, you have a lot on your plate as you look at the back end of this system. What is your top priority as you take on this new role? What is your immediate attention?
Well, you know, my top overall priority for the Department of Corrections is to engage in bipartisan criminal justice reform that will have a very broad impact on the criminal justice system in Wisconsin as a whole. That was one of Governor Evers' priorities when he got elected, and it was that priority, along with others, that convinced me to accept the position of Secretary of DOC.
What does bipartisan criminal justice reform look like to you? How do you get there?
Well, you know, I believe that you get there by engaging all stakeholders that have an interest in criminal justice issues and listening to the people and hearing what their concerns are about the criminal justice system, working with legislators who also hear those concerns and the governor's office, and creating an environment where we can share ideas and work towards solutions that are going to lower recidivism, lower the cost to taxpayers, lower our overall inmate population, which is one of the governor's goals, and increase public safety at the same time by changing the lives of those that we care for in our institutions and those that we care for in the community.
So Wisconsin is in the process of closing Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake Juvenile Correctional Institutions. Governor Evers announced that the closure would take longer than the Walker administration had intended. So can you give us an update on this process? Where are we at?
Sure. First of all, the legislature at this point has clearly indicated that they also agree that there's going to be more time needed to actually close Lincoln Hills because the timeline is so short, and they have heard from the counties that they need more time to build the facilities that were envisioned by the passage of Act 185. But the governor's budget clearly indicates, and I agree with the governor on this, is that we will close Lincoln Hills as soon as there is an appropriate facility to place them in. That means the day that we have new bed space that complies with the new vision for criminal justice, which is based on a model called Closer to Home, we will close Lincoln Hills on that very day, as soon as we possibly can. There's nothing more important to the governor and myself than, you know, the safety and security of our kids and closing Lincoln Hills as soon as possible. To create artificial deadlines that maybe you can meet or not, just, you know, to me doesn't comport with reality.
We're talking with Kevin Carr, as Secretary Designee for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. You have a line, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the head of the Department of Corrections? Do you support Governor Evers' proposal regarding criminal justice? What do you want to see changed? What does criminal justice reform mean to you? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Lucy now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Lucy.
Hi. I wanted to ask Mr. Carr. I wanted to say that there's I definitely support increasing pay for prison guards, because I've talked to a couple prison guards who they're really under a lot of stress and pressure. They have to work extra shifts, and that's just dangerous for them and the prisoners. And I also wanted to ask if there's any pot of money that could be used right away to add more guards and more social workers, things like that, so that the kids in the Lincoln Hills are getting better treatment that would probably help them act better rather than just strip searching and pepper spraying.
Lucy, thanks for the call. And what do we know about changes that can get underway at Lincoln Hills before we even build these smaller youth detention centers around the state?
Lucy, thank you for your question. That's a really good question to ask. And we're working closely with the court-ordered monitor. Of course, I will preface that by saying we're under a court-ordered consent decree, which means that the state of Wisconsin and the plaintiffs in the case, the ACLU and unnamed individuals that I shouldn't really name, have agreed to have a court-ordered monitor oversee changes that we are supposed to make at Lincoln Hills and then report back to the court to tell the court what the progress of those changes are. So we're working with the monitor, we're working with the ACLU, we're working with Wisconsin and national experts to ensure that the youth currently housed at Lincoln Hills receive the proper mental health care, education, and support that they need to be successful. That also includes trying to address our staffing shortage. The day that I walked into this office, the Department of Corrections had between 700 and 800 vacancies. And the governor is attempting to address that issue. We are trying to address that issue by looking at increasing the compensation for the starting wages for officers working in the Department of Corrections. right now, our starting wage that we offer a starting correctional officer or a youth counselor is around $16.32 an hour. Our surrounding states pay considerably more for people doing the exact same amount of work. Right now in the state of Wisconsin, with the unemployment rate being around 2.9%, which is relatively low, the competition for labor and employees is extremely strong. And so we're looking at compensating our staff in a more appropriate way in order to fill some of these vacancies that currently exist.
Secretary Carr, the court-ordered monitor also said in this report that the guards continue to work 16-hour shifts many days in a row, and they're not swiftly responding to inmates' calls for help. How would you respond to that?
Well, you know, just a week ago or so, I was at Lincoln Hills where we graduated one of our largest classes of youth counselors, which was 18. And prior to them coming online this week, there were multiple dozens of overtime shifts available. I was told last week by my management staff there that after the graduation of that class, the number of shifts available for overtime went down to 5. So that's out of a staff of between 1 and 200 individuals working up there. So we're moving in the right direction. You know, we're never going to be satisfied with the staffing level until every available position is filled. And we have another class going right now. So, you know, the more staff that you have, as was indicated by Lucy earlier, the lower the staff-to-youth ratio is, and the better care that we can provide our youth in that facility.
Looking at the Green Bay Correctional Institution houses 300 more inmates than it was originally designed for. Replacing it is estimated to cost $500 million. Governor not including funds for that in his budget. What can we be done about overcrowding?
Well, as I said earlier, my top priority is to engage in bipartisan criminal justice reform in a similar way that has happened in many states around the country. I just attended a terrific meeting last night at Marquette University where the discussion was all about criminal justice reform that has recently taken place in the state of Michigan. And the state of Michigan, through smart, thoughtful, bipartisan, and quite frankly, it was initially Republican-led criminal justice reforms, they were able to close 5 prisons within the last few years.
We have to pause right there. Secretary Kevin Carr with us as our guide, looking at the issues surrounding Lincoln Hills, other issues in criminal justice reform. You have a line, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Wisconsin's Corrections Secretary here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Lincoln Hills Youth Prison and a number of other correctional facilities across the state are facing staffing shortages, as we've been talking about. In effort to address that, the governor's budget would increase pay for guards to around $18 an hour. One of the issues we're addressing here. You can join in, 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to happen regarding juvenile criminal justice in Wisconsin? Do you support smaller regional facilities? What about raising pay for guards, increasing the age for charging juveniles as an adult from 17 to 18? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Department of Corrections Secretary Designee Kevin Carr stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with John joining us from Janesville. Good morning, John.
Good morning. So I had a couple little comments I wanted to make. So my brother was charged as an adult when I was younger, and he was kind of thrust into the system pretty quickly, and it was pretty traumatic for my family. And so I guess a couple comments that I wanted to make were, you know, is there anything that we're doing to help families and, you know, the kind of this, the impact it can have on families? The second was, you know, with, you know, the abuse of confinement. And also, what are we doing to help prepare these people to get out? Because I'm seeing my brother still struggle with trying to get on his feet. And luckily, he has a family that's still trying to help him. But, I mean, it's I know it can be a lot harder out there for other people.
John, thanks so much for that perspective. And John's brother still struggling to get on his feet, Secretary?
Yes. And John, thank you for your call this morning. I'm glad that you asked that question because reentry is one of the primary focuses of the governor's budget this year. We're really excited to see some of his reentry proposals, such as we have a successful program in DOC called OARS, or Opening Avenues to Reentry Success, that is currently in 44 states. The governor has proposed that we expand that really successful program to all 72 counties in the state. And OARS helps those with mental health diagnoses navigate their progress in reintegration to the communities by providing them with job opportunities, training opportunities, health care, including mental health services and medication and other supports in order for them to be successful in the community. We also, under the governor's budget, are expanding our Windows to Work program and job centers in our prisons. We're asking for four more job centers in our facilities around the state so that those that we care for in our facilities can start to look for job training or job opportunities once they reenter our communities.
John,
we have several programs, we have several programs throughout the system where we train people and provide them with certifications to get jobs once they get out into the community. I'm sorry, Kate,
yeah,
go ahead.
John also brought up solitary confinement, and at least one Wisconsin inmate recently went on a hunger strike to protest the practice of solitary. Activists have called for ending the practice entirely. What purpose does solitary confinement serve in Wisconsin's institutions?
Well, the governor has made it clear that reducing the use of solitary or segregation is one of his priorities, and it's one of mine as well. And there have been several states around the country who have engaged in that process and reduced the use of segregation by providing their staffs with different management tools to use to manage people's behavior while they're in custody. Wisconsin is going in that direction. There are many facilities that I have visited already that have started to implement some very exciting and new strategies on how to reduce the use of segregation in our facilities. The need for segregation may never entirely go away to zero, though we would love it to, because there are some folks that, you know, whether it's through mental illness or other reasons, are just extremely violent, and they're dangerous to themselves, staff, and other inmates. And we have to find a very humane and safe way to manage that population. And we're committed to moving in that direction.
Lots of people who would like to talk with you. Let's go to Jeff now in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning. Mr. Secretary, I got a question. I was reading an article about Massachusetts Department of Corrections recently. They started a program with so many people coming into the system with active addictions, and a lot of it is opioid, and there's others, other addictions as well. They're offering to inmates who want it, not to everybody, but Suboxone, Methadone, Vivitrol, in hopes that if they start on a path to abate their addiction, that when they do reenter, that they don't go right back to active addiction, which usually was kind of a route that got them in there in the first place. Is Wisconsin looking at something like that by chance?
I'm glad you asked that question, Jeff, because the Department of Corrections currently is one of the country's leaders in the use of Vivitrol. I just had members of my staff present at a national conference to inform other states as to what we're doing with our Vivitrol program here at DOC.
Jeff, thanks for the call. And let's go to Sandra now in Waukesha. Sandra, hi.
Hi. I'm calling Secretary Carr to find out what is happening as far as a plan to the work on the release of hundreds of parole-eligible inmates who have been sentenced under the old law and who have been in prison quite a few years over their parole-eligible date.
Sandra, thank you.
Thank you for your call and your question. Currently, the governor is in the process of selecting a parole commissioner, a permanent appointment, and I know that that issue is important to the governor and myself because I believe, and the governor as well, that that's all part of the comprehensive criminal justice reform that needs to take place to look at the three categories of law that are seriously impacting our prison populations, old law prisoners, new law prisoners, and truth and sentencing prisoners. And the biggest group of those right now is the truth and sentencing prisoners because they have determinate sentences. That means they have to serve every single day that they were sentenced to. And 50 or 60 or life means exactly that, 50, 60 or life. The old law prisoners are starting to age out of the system, so they're a smaller group. But what we're doing about that is, you know, again, we hope to address a lot of the issues that those categories have in impacting our prisoner population by engaging the legislature in comprehensive criminal justice reform. The parole aspect of it is something that is certainly going to be addressed by the appointment of a permanent new parole commissioner who has a vision of parole that aligns with the governor's.
Well, as we wrap up here, Milwaukee County has a plan to transition all health care for inmates in-house, moving away from using private companies for medical services. What's your take on this? You worked in Milwaukee County for decades.
I believe that Milwaukee County is probably moving in the right direction, but that's a policy decision for them to decide.
Well, Secretary Carr, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. And, thank you for your time and interest. And the DOC is an agency that's very large. We have 10,000 employees and 37 facilities around the state, 131 probation and parole offices, and all of the employees that I've encountered at the Department of Corrections are just tremendous professionals that I'm just proud to work with every day.
We'll leave it there. Kevin Carr, Secretary Designee for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Just ahead, Wisconsin lawmakers are promoting a plan that would make the state's process for handling sexual assault kits. We'll talk with one of the lawmakers behind the bill. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.